Listeners, it is the morning of January 30th. We are currently in the shadow of the first major crash involving a US-based airline since 2009. We recorded this episode last Sunday, the 26th, before the tragic events at DC's National Airport. We will be covering that incident extensively in our next episode, when we know more. In the meantime, if you want to hear our thoughts on the incident, the best place to do so is on our Discord. Thank you. Back to the show. Hello, and welcome to Controlled Pod Into Terrain. We are a multimedia podcast about air and space mishaps, aiming to put them in the broader context of how and why things went wrong. Now to introduce myself and my co-hosts. My name is Ariadne Talchik. I'm the business and aviation industry expert. My pronouns are she and her.
My name is Jay. Well, it isn't, but that's all you're getting. I'm the systems and engineering expert, and my pronouns can be she and her as well, as a treat.
And my name is Kira Dempsey, better known as the aviation writer Admiral Cloudberg, and my pronouns are she and her. And today, because we're going to talk a lot about weather, we invited our friend who has weather autism.
Hello, I am Beck. You can ask me about weather. My pronouns are also she and her.
Next slide. Today we're going to talk about Braniff 250, which is a tragic story of what happens when a string of poor decisions put 42 people directly into the path of turbulence so strong that not even our beloved 111 could save them. Next slide. But first, we have to do some sort of news thing. And this is going to be a news-heavy episode because this crash was a long time ago, it wasn't that complicated, and there were, as far as we can tell, no crimes involved.
And on top of that, we haven't released an episode in several months, and they were very eventful months if you're into planes, so let's start with some of the crashes that happened during that time, because there were a bunch. Next slide. First off, back on 25th November 2024, a Swift Air Cargo 737-400 operating on behalf of, why does it say SHI? I thought it was DHL. It was DHL branded.
Should to be DHL.
But crashed about a kilometer short of the runway in Vilnius, Lithuania. Of the four crew on board, three of them survived, and one of the pilots was killed. It also badly damaged a house that had a dozen people in it, but they all escaped.
Yeah, I'm not cutting the DHL thing out, incidentally. This is going to be a long episode. This was basically a CFIT accident. We don't know the details of how it happened yet. It was obvious from the surveillance video that the plane was on a completely unstabilized approach. It started descending below the glide slope shortly before the crash after a sudden increase in descent rate. We don't know why.
Images from the scene suggest that the slats might have been retracted, which means the flaps would have been too. But this is a point in the approach where those high lift devices have to be extended for low speed, high drag flight. If they were never extended, then clearly the pilots were way behind the aircraft on this approach. But it's also possible that they were extended and then there was some miscommunication and they were retracted again, leading to a high sink rate. We don't really know which, and we won't know for a while, because Lithuania hasn't met the ICAO Annex 13 requirement to release a preliminary report within 30 days.
Apparently this is due to coordination issues with the simultaneously ongoing judicial investigation. This is the first major air accident in Lithuania since independence in 1990, so it's not surprising that issues like this will arise. This was a DHL-branded aircraft, but it's not a DHL operated. It was operated by a contractor called Swift Air, which I was wildly disappointed to find out has nothing to do with my Lord and Savior, but is instead a Spanish Aero Supra knockoff that loves to do sketchy shit and cut corners, perhaps in this case a little too literally. Next slide. Also, back in November, Spirit and American Airlines got shot at in Haiti. You thought we were going to go a whole episode without talking about aviation crimes? Nah.
The Google Docs just say, "We blame Reagan." I think that's about as much detail as we're going to get on this one.
Yeah. Not much damage was done to the planes, but it's enough of a thing we wanted to touch on it really quickly. The bullets that hit a JetBlue flight did strike a flight attendant, but they recovered quickly. The planes also escaped any sort of damage that would have prevented them from getting the fuck out of the place they were being shot at, which we hear on this podcast called El Carlito. One of them apparently hit the avionics bay, but did not affect any critical systems.
The FAA shut down traffic from the U.S. to Haiti for 30 days and then opened up after the airport's beefed up security.
Yeah, so everything, I just want to say, everything that has been done to Haiti since Europeans colonized it has been a crime. So that's our crime for this episode.
Well, there's others, but okay.
There's lots of crimes, yeah. Next slide.
Oh, true. This is a crime. So we do have more to say about Azerbaijan. So on Christmas morning, an Azerbaijan Airlines Embraer E190 from Baku, Azerbaijan to Grozny, Russia, was hit by a Russian air defense Pantsir missile battery during an unsuccessful landing attempt amid fog and GPS jamming. Shrapnel peppered the aft fuselage, causing a depressurization and injuring passengers.
The pilots reported that they lost hydraulics and had no control over the airplane. They pulled a United 232 and maintained basic control using variable engine thrust, but they were all over the place. And at one point, ATC was reportedly warning them that they were below the MSA, the minimum safe altitude, in the Caucasus Mountains.
In one of the videos from the cabin, you can hear a flight attendant telling people to move to the back. So we think they might have been moving passengers around in order to trim the airplane.
Yeah, I mean, but not trim it too much, because the only way they had to control their altitude would have been, power and the Fugoid. And that's what we call a situation.
So eventually the crew decided to proceed to Aktau in Kazakhstan on the other side of the freaking Caspian Sea, because it was the only place with clear weather. And there was a lot of speculation after the crash that Russia refused to let them land in Makhachkala, but the ATC tapes refute this.
Russia vectored them out to sea as a cover-up, rings close enough to plausible that this rumor took quite a foothold, but alas, it is not true.
Yeah. So without hydraulics, they managed to stay airborne for an hour and a half, and they made it all the way to Aktau, but they lost control and crashed during their second landing attempt. The front and center sections were crushed in a giant fireball, but the tail section was shot out ahead like a curling stone for like a kilometer, and everyone in there survived. So in total, 38 people died and 29 lived, which for a plane that got hit by a literal missile is pretty damn good.
Also, absolute chat-ass flying. Truly DHL grade.
That's a reference to the 2003 Baghdad shootdown incident where a DHL cargo A300 was hit by a missile, lost hydraulics, and the pilots landed it not just in one piece, but actually on its landing gear. Still the only time anyone has ever done this, and we should definitely do an episode on this at some point, even if only because of the family relationship between the 111 and the A300.
Yeah, and these Azerbaijan Airlines guys did a damn good job too, though. I mean, they're unquestionably heroes for getting that far.
Yeah, and who the hell knows if we're ever going to get a detailed investigation into this crash? But according to unverified leaks from Russia's internal military investigation, Ukrainian drones had been operating that area previously, and Russians had GPS and comms jamming active, but I guess they jammed their own military comms too.
Yeah, they did. Classic Russian military competence.
For unknown reasons, the plane wasn't displayed to the Pantsir crew as a friendly, and the crew had not been supplied with any civilian aircraft schedules.
I mean, come on, guys. They teach this in How Not to Shoot Down Civilian Planes 101.
Bold of you to think they were teaching these guys anything. So, two Pantsir crews were trying to figure out if this plane was a threat. They couldn't get through to their commanders because their own military was jamming them. One battery saw the plane and identified it as civilian, but the other didn't. And the first battery couldn't tell them because cell communication was down and the landline didn't work for unrelated reasons, presumably because someone had stolen the copper.
Yeah, probably. Also, according to this version, there was never a Ukrainian drone in the area on that day, or at least if there was, it got away because they never found any trace of it. So add it to the pile of embarrassing Russian moments involving anti-air missiles and civilian airliners, which is a worryingly large pile.
This was a wild story to unpack on the server, because when we saw the photos emerge, the first thing Jay and I said to each other was, those holes look concerningly like anti-air fragmentation shrapnel. There was some rumor right around afterwards about it having potentially come from a disintegrating engine core, but this was so clearly anti-air that even Russia had to admit it.
I mean, they didn't admit it, but they had to. You're right.
Yeah.
All right, next slide.
All right, speaking of that, of Russia, on the same day, an SSJ-100 caught on fire at Anatolia Airport in Turkey, and everybody on board evacuated safely.
We have no idea why this happened, and we have nothing actually real to say about it, but Ari and Jay wrote some funny jokes about the SSJ 100, and we wanted to tell them.
So, as you know, every Russian jet is, we have jet at home. And this particular one is, we have A220 at home. It's the Russian domestic market's attempt to make a modern fly-by-wire regional jet. And it's even got a couple of CFM56 knockoffs. And I do mean knockoffs. They were initially a joint venture with Snecma.
Did you just dead name Safran?
But since the invasion, the French got the fuck out of town, leaving a company I'll let Pierre to pronounce, to take over the entire effort domestically.
It's literally just ODK Saturn NPO.
Everything about this gen is a mess, and despite its claims of being Russian-made and Russian-shrunk, most of the parts are still Western, from companies like Honeywell and BAE. And the sanctions mean those parts aren't coming. And even making a dog shit knockoff still takes a decade.
Look, I know you talked about the crimes involved in shooting at planes, but I don't think we can all sit here as reasonable people and pretend that the sucky superjet... that's Sukhoi Superjet, is anything but a collection of crimes, from sanctions evasion to industrial espionage. You've talked before about how they're totally dependent on tenuous relationships with the Middle East and India to get stuff in, and despite talking a load of old toot about developing replacements for Western components, Russian industry is just nowhere near capable of doing this. They don't even have the university pipeline to staff the companies that develop the parts to build the equipment that they would need to gather the data to develop these components. That's how far behind they are. And they can't afford any of it even if they did, which is why they're building quote-unquote Russified versions of the damn thing based on sanction-smuggled chips and cloned firmware that they put in modules based on reverse-engineered versions of whatever Honeywell or BAE or GE was providing. Does this work? Sometimes, sort of. Is it safe? Apparently not. Is it a massive crime wrapped in a different crime? Yes, definitely.
Next slide. All right, last but definitely not least, the one you've been waiting for us to cover, Jeju Air Flight 2213, otherwise known as That's Why We Don't Put ILS Berms There.
This was a Boeing 737-800 passenger flight from Bangkok, Thailand to Muan, South Korea, with 181 people on board. It crashed on landing on December 29th, killing 179 people. Only the two aft flight attendants survived. So on final approach, they hit birds, and we can confirm at this time that bird detritus was found inside both engines. The technical term for this, by the way, is snarge.
That's fantastic. Now, we don't know how much damage this did, but from video evidence, the right engine had a compressor stall in the air, and the left engine thrust reverser wasn't used on landing. So both engines might have been fucked by the birds. So why did they try to go around with two fucked engines?
Well, you know, the working assumption has to be that they started the go-around when they saw the birds or felt the impacts and only realized how fucked their engines were after they had committed to it.
Now, after the go-around started, the plane disappeared off Flight Radar 24 and both black boxes stopped recording. So there's no data in the entire last 4 minutes of the flight, and this is presumably because there was a total loss of electrical power when the engines failed.
Which is weird, though, because you can hear at least one engine spinning down after the crash on the excellent quality video that came off some guy's, presumably Samsung, smartphone. The accessory drive on these engines is off of N2, the high pressure spool, so even if the fan was fucked and it wasn't producing any thrust, you would still expect there to be electricity if the engine core was rotating.
Yeah, which I was right, I was just about to get to that. I mean, the suspicion is that there was something wrong with the electrical system other than just dual engine failure. I mean, that's pure speculation. We don't have direct evidence of that, but I would not be shocked if it was the case.
And yes, aircraft built before 2009, like this one, weren't required to have the CDR run off the backup battery. The 737 doesn't have a Raymar turbine because it doesn't actually need electrical power to fly. It can be flown with manual reversion, as we talked about for TACA 110 in the last episode. You have to start the APU to get the flight recorders back online, and the pilots didn't have time to do it because I think it takes about 90 to 120 seconds in the 737.
Yeah, and they didn't have a handy Czech pilot in the back of the cockpit to take over. We asked ourselves if we can blame Boeing for this somehow, but we're not going to because, you know, that other disaster podcast has ruined all of those jokes on this topic.
So, based on video evidence, what we know is that during those final 4 minutes, they circled the airport and they landed on runway 19 from the opposite direction. This was probably an attempt to return to the nearest runway because the go-around, or such as it was, had made it impossible to continue to landing on runway 01, which was their original intention.
Which, by the way, the official advice if you lose an engine on final approach is to not worry about it and just land directly ahead of you. This is why it's called the impossible turn.
Yeah, although the impossible turn is coming back around to land on the same run or in the opposite direction of the same runway you just took off from, which is even harder than this.
Yeah, I mean, making a super tight turn back with little or no engine power is insanely hard. And for whatever reason, the pilots did not manage to extend the landing gear. It can be extended manually with a gravity drop, even with no hydraulic or electrical power, but maybe the pilots thought they didn't have time. We might actually never know the answer to this because the CVR wasn't running.
Yeah. Anyway, they touched down too fast, too far down the runway, with no gear, so that means no brakes and also no spoilers, and maybe one thrust reverser at most. So in short, they were fucked. There was no way that plane was going to stop within any reasonable distance of the runway end. So my opinion is that this would have been a major crash no matter what. But I think most people would have survived if the plane hadn't smashed headlong into the concrete-reinforced support berm for the localizer antenna array, at which point it disintegrated into a cloud of fiery, frozly bits.
This is why we make structures near your runway frangible, folks.
Frangible means that when a plane and the structure get into a fight, the plane wins.
Yeah, it's also pretty obvious that this structure this sturdy should not have been anywhere near as close to the runway, and while South Korea is starting the process of removing these at other airports, geez, they paid just the highest price for this hindsight.
Yeah, we learned that too after MK Airlines Flight 1602, and we no longer have a berm with our ILS on it in Halifax anymore because it crashed into it.
Great shout, yeah.
Was that the 747 that overran and broke in half?
It did. It had a whole bunch of lobsters on it, so there was lobster all over the runway, which is very stereotypical.
It broke into a lot more than half. There have been two 747 runway overruns at Halifax, and you're probably thinking of the other one. But, yeah. Anyway.
One tragic piece of information to note is that the executive that is in charge of the airport design company took his life earlier this week. He was expecting to be charged by the Korean National Police for his role in the incident. His role in specifically approving the ILS is unknown right now.
Yeah. And we're recording this on Sunday night, and the Korean Transport Ministry has said they'll release the preliminary report on Monday, so it should be out by the time you hear this. Actually, it's already out right now. I'm recording this. It came out, like, literally seconds before we started recording this episode, but apparently it doesn't really tell us anything we didn't already just say. So, carry on. Next slide.
All right, our next section is aviation stocks to Ariadne. And we're going to talk about the moving and shaking in the aerospace sector. It's making and losing money for the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund and by other people, I guess. The Boeing strike is over. After years of dealing with wage freezes, rising healthcare costs, frustrations over job security, the Washington state-based Boeing Machinists Union finally threw down the gauntlet. Picture this. Thousands of workers in Washington, Oregon, and beyond, putting on their tools and walking out, leaving assembly lines still and quiet. It wasn't just a bump in the road for Boeing, it was a full-scale halt, sending a strong message that the machinists were done fucking around. The first book to strike was hugely popular, and for good reason. Boeing has spent the last 2.5 decades doing everything they can to break the back of this particular union. The unique way that the 787 is built and assembled, mostly based around the fact that Boeing moved the entire production line to South Carolina, where saying the word union will get you arrested, was done to try and break them. Even their move from Seattle to Chicago in the early 2000s was to break the back of this specific union. And Boeing has repeatedly shot themselves in the foot out of spite, putting up with constant delays, QA problems, and work stoppages in the South Carolina factory because they could pay workers in the South 12 to 16 bucks an hour to build one of the most complicated machines ever devised. For weeks, Boeing and Machinists Union butted heads, waiting for each other to blink. Unions demanded wage, better wages, retirement benefits, reasonable healthcare costs. Boeing, on the other hand, was playing usual fuckery, citing tough economic conditions and the needs to stay competitive. Translation, stocks. We spent all your money on buybacks. Sorry. Boeing tried all kinds of bullshit to end this shit. But the machinists union held strong, because they did that for the first time in a minute. They held all the leverage. They rejected Boeing's first insultingly low offer with near unanimity, and they laughed when Boeing declared their offer best and final. And as the business expert, this was one of the funniest things I ever read. You see that when you have options. You see that when you have another vendor waiting. You see it when you've got a flush. You don't see it when you're holding a 6, an 8, an Uno card, a Chick-fil-A receipt, and a goldfish.
I would be so busy laughing at my opponent slapping a goldfish and an Uno reverse card onto the poker table that I'd forget to vote to continue the strike. It's a genius move, you see.
Well, needless to say, the union saw through the goldfish. They told Boeing to fuck all the way back to Puget Sound, and Boeing looked really stupid.
Let's not forget the ripple effects. Boeing's strike didn't just affect their factories, it sent shockwaves throughout the entire aerospace industry, the entire stock chain, all of the supply chain stuff. Delayed orders, missed deadlines, made it crystal clear that the machinists were not bluffing about how crucial they are to Boeing's operations.
Eventually, the strike started to affect earnings guidance, and institutional investors decided to step in to demand an end to the strike. Which is the first time at CPIT you'll hear about massive stockholders being used for a net good.
Maybe the last time.
Maybe the last time, probably. Boeing realized they had nothing, so they put better wages on the table, offered some relief in healthcare premiums, guaranteed some of the job protections that the machinists were asking for. It was not a perfect deal. It was enough for the machinists to feel like they were finally heard, for Boeing to finally make some concessions. It was a way to get production rolling again without any more bleeding. In the end, the strike was a reality check for Boeing. The machinists proved they weren't just cogs in the machine. They were the machine. And for the workers, it was a win to prove that when you stand up and you demand what's fair, sometimes you actually get it. Unionize your fucking office. All of this, though, belies one fact. Boeing is still totally screwed. Because the following things are still true about Boeing. The 777X is still years behind schedule because the thrust link and all their prototypes were aging like they chose unwisely on the railroad. They finally fixed it, but best estimates put delivery dates in 2026, 7 years after the original goal. That means the delay is 50% longer than the entire dev cycle for the original 777. Their Starliner capsule may very well never fly again. They are only making 55 units of their bread and butter 737 from a single factory in Renton every month, 20 less than they need to be.
Airbus, let's remember, has 4 320 factories, not just for capacity, but also for redundancy. And let's just remember that 320 deliveries passed 737 deliveries, despite the fact that the plane is more than 10 years younger.
Almost 20 years younger.
It's, yeah, literally 20.
It's stacking tin is what that 320 is.
Two of the satellites they built the Central Bus for have just up and exploded in geostationary orbit in the last year. They've announced that they're ending production of the 767 freighter early. The 787, apart from having a 2,000-word-long section on Wikipedia called Operational Problems, is actually doing okay. Also, the T-7, which is replacing the T-38 as the primary jet trainer for the Air Force, is finally getting delivered way too slowly. The KC-96, which is a replacement for the 135 and the KC-10, is still climbing over the mountains of problems that it brought on itself. All of this to say is that their issues are numerous and their wins small. Boeing has a hugely uphill battle just to get back to normal. They are still having huge problems with their manufacturing. They're not making anything at the speed they need to be or the quality they need to be at. They have a debt load worth $60 billion. And while they have the ability to raise a lot of money and credit lines worth tens of billions, $60 billion is a lot of fucking money. And they're going to need at least another 20 to actually develop and test the 797.
Look at this fool who thinks Boeing will ever build a 797. They're going to leave it there to tantalize us forever like Half-Life 3.
Looking fondly at the model of the Sonic Cruiser concepts and saying that I'll see her in my wildest dreams.
And they still haven't unfucked their supply chains either, and the strike has emboldened labor all the way up and down the value line.
So, Boeing has a pretty steep climb to stability, let alone profitability. All right, next slide. All right, let's talk about everyone's favorite school bus that isn't driven by an ADHD lesbian, and how they continue to lose money to the point where they can no longer continue to operate without significant debt restructuring and downsizing.
You don't know that. Some of the crew could be ADHD lesbians.
Headcanoning Miss Frizzle as a lesbian makes the magic school bus 10 times cooler. Or is that official canon? It's been a long time since I read any magic school bus.
I mean, she's definitely queer-coded, and I will die on this hill if I need to.
I'll die with you.
I will too.
Yeah, no, we're all... I think we're all there. All right. So in mid-November, Spirit Airlines declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It is important to clarify, especially for those outside the U.S., this is not the end of the company. It is a common misconception that all bankruptcies involve liquidations of assets, to pay off company debt, going out of business, you know, sort of your Bed Bath & Beyond kind of thing. That's a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. By contrast, Chapter 11 bankruptcy is designed to allow operations to continue, employees who paid as normal as part of a restructuring process. So kind of called a go and sin no more from a court system. Chapter 11 is not uncommon in your airline industry. Every single one of the American Big Three have done it, as have many of their component airlines pre-merger. They've all emerged either or continue flying their current incarnation, or in some cases, an emerged entity. Spirit's incarnation, once it emerges from bankruptcy, remains to be seen, although in any event, it will be a smaller and leaner operation. So Spirit, as you remember from episode 9, back in the fall, has been screwed a couple of different ways. For starters, as we discussed, Spirit has gotten deeply fucked by the issues with the Pratt & Whitney PW1100, which is the geared turbofan that has something like a 13-to-1 bypass ratio, which is unmatched in the world.
For now, Rolls is really trying to make the ultra fan happen.
Yeah, the problem is it achieves bypass ratios like that with the use of a planetary gear set between the turbine section and the fan. Because if you have a huge fan, you need to spin slowly so it doesn't tear itself apart. So you have to make a reduction gearbox that's small and light enough to fit inside the hub of the jet engine, but it has to be able to handle the tens of thousands of newton meters of torque, and it has to be capable of operating both in the desert of Dubai and the snow of Saskatchewan for years on end. That is right up against the limit of human understanding material science. These gearboxes are constantly trying to explode, something that is less than advisable for continued airline operations. This, combined with some bad materials used in the second stage compressor core, means that a lot of their planes are grounded until inspections and repairs can be complete. Spirit has, at times, had some of their planes sitting for months. So they're going to spend 2025 and 2026 operating between 2/3 and 3/4 of their full fleet. They won't get their full fleet back until 2027 at the earliest. Combine that with the fact that the legacy carriers have been able to vivisect this small segment of increasingly cash-strapped budget traveler by introducing their own fuck-you-pay-me fees. Because fundamentally, what Spirit offers is an uncomfortable seat with too little room and the ability to pay extra for everything from water to the ability to bring a bag. And that is pretty easy to replicate, actually. The Big Three carriers can all do that. And the amp ride you get with them will be nicer because you're attached to a global route network and you're more likely getting a decent IFE and the Big Three level of service for whatever that's worth.
You're joking about the IFE. I've flown all three of the Big Three domestically in scum class because anything else would be defrauding my Patreon supporters. And I can assure you, the percent of those planes that have IFE is like 20%.
The Spirit saw a domestic vacation travel within the U.S. bounce back quickly after the worst pandemic restrictions were lifted, and they got being able to expand quickly to cater to it. They spent and borrowed huge amounts of money into training and operation sectors, and of course they built massive office headquarters and paid huge tens of bonuses to their executive suite. The growth that they manifested never materialized or was offset by major competition from legacy airlines. They also had overcapacity problems, particularly in their strongest markets, Orlando, South Florida, Vegas, international markets in Central and South America. And some problems were out of their control. During the last 2 years, they had expensive, drawn-out merger negotiations and legal proceedings with both Frontier and JetBlue. So Spirit was kind of hamstrung from making significant adjustments to their business model by contractual agreement. An example of this is they have restrictions on furloughing pilots during merger transactions in progress, so they were sort of overstaffed. Now those merger talks ended, Spirit had to furlough 500 pilots across a couple of rounds. A lot of that result of these new airframe groundings. They sold off aircraft to free up cash. They reduced their pilot count down below 3,000. One positive sign is that a supermajority of the debt holders that Spirit owes money to voted in favor of the company's restructuring and downsizing plan before they entered bankruptcy court in what's called a prearranged restructuring agreement. Basically, it's a plan to get themselves out of trouble. The actual court is going to examine the plan, make sure the T's are dotted and the I's are crossed, and recommend any further measures if I wrote it backwards and read it backwards.
It's funnier that way.
Yeah, I thought it was funny.
It should be kept.
It's funnier that way. Okay. All right. The court itself is going to evaluate the agreement, make sure the T's are dotted, the I's are crossed, and recommend any further measures that are best interested to the debtors. Spirit is, they're pretty sure they've got everything covered. They would like to emerge from it sometime in the first quarter of this year. So, we got all that out of the way. What does this mean for you, the Broadcast Traveler? Naturally, not much. So this is a chapter of bankruptcy. Unlike what we said about unlike what Bed Bath & Beyond just did, where it ceased to exist, all its assets were given to creditors, solved to pay debts. This is a go out to debt no more. The debts are reorganized. Courts or creditors usually are told to accept a few pennies on the dollar by the courts. Interestingly, one of the things that the court did grant the creditors was most of the remaining portion of Spirit's outstanding shares, meaning it's sort of a private company-ish. They are also cutting a ton of stuff, as we discussed back in episode 9, back in 2016. The bonuses to those executives, don't worry, those are still valid because they argued, as companies always do, that they needed to retain all this quality talent. Is that the same talent that got them into this? Shut up, peasant. Don't ask questions. In an entertainingly ironic twist, Spirit's ownership of their sexy new headquarters, operations, and training facility we put up as collateral as part of the restructuring agreement. So, nice work on paying a bunch of money to secure our bankruptcy dorks, remote work forever. To put this in terms most listeners of this show would understand, Spirit is kind of right now where Apple was in 1997. I'm not saying that I expect Spirit's next set of plans to be Bondi Blue and translucent, but what I mean is they're a little bloated right now. So in 1987, Apple faced fierce competition from Microsoft when it tried to match them with their own game selling sort of generic beige boxes. They overextended into a bunch of stuff like printers, servers, a bunch of crappy Mac models. And when Steve Jobs came back, he made a lot of unpopular decisions. He laid off something like 3,000 employees, cut 80% of the product lineup, focused on the leaner organization with the core strengths. He redefined their branding, their advertising. This resulted in the Think Different campaign that was so sort of closely associated with the late 90s iMac and Return of Steve. So Spirit is kind of doing something very similar, but much less likely to get them an Oscar-nominated movie in a couple of decades. They've sold off much of excess aircraft. We talked about layoffs, eliminated a bunch of routes, particularly in Florida, to concentrate on stronger markets, Northeast, California, Texas. At the same time, they've significantly changed their business model to offer premium seating options and all-inclusive tech models to improve the customer experience. If this makes them sound like they're kind of becoming every other airline, even though you notice that too. Spirit hired an advertising agency for the first time. They've ramped up their advertising efforts. They hired Frankie Muniz for a short commercial that parodies his time on Malcolm in the Middle to promote their blocked middle seat options, which, I mean, I guess we can bring Euro business to America. Who knows? Why not? If anything, these changes represent an impressive display of contingency planning in the event of a merger not being approved in the near future, which is probably very likely going to happen. Spirit implemented this model change and debt restructuring plan 7 months after the federal court shot down JetBlue merger. All of this aside, their long-term prospects remain pretty questionable. They're still shopping themselves around to Frontier, JetBlue, God knows who else. It's a fair bet they'll take advantage of the more merger-friendly policies in the next couple of years to this purpose. In the near term, Spirit has had their sort of come to Jesus moment, if you will. They've admitted themselves that they're not going to be able to continue to operate at the current size and growth vector given the revenue numbers. So more to follow, but continue as we follow the bafflingly shitty little school bus that could.
Now, because we should have done another Oops All News episode, but made the questionable decision not to, Jay and Ari are going to quick fire through 4 more news stories.
All right, Starship landed the booster, but massively failed to get to orbit, with pieces out causing absolute chaos over a few hundred miles of airspace around Turks and Caicos. I think this is a problem, but not a major one. I put return to flight less than 90 days.
It depends how mad the airlines get about the massive amount of money this shit just costs them in diversions and whether the FAA does its fucking job, which is questionable at this point.
New Glenn got to orbit, failed to land a booster. We haven't seen anything about this other than in their ship, Jacqueline, returned to port empty. Blorigin says it, quote, fell short. I called it, landing is a psychotically hard problem, and you're not starting with Hawthorne's hundreds of flights. You're starting with a couple of dozen New Shepard flights.
You said it would explode, and it didn't. You also thought that BE-3U, the upper stage engine, wouldn't work, which it did. I just want to point out that it was also really, really pretty. Anyway, I also want to point out that not landing actually kind of doesn't matter. What does is that on its first flight, New Glenn's lower and upper stages performed pretty much flawlessly in demonstrating its ability to put gobsmackingly large masses into a specific target orbit.
Some dipshit flew a DJI piece of shit over the LA fires and managed to put a Super Scooper out of service for a week. Well done, you absolute fucking cockwomble. Interesting week, DJI responded to this by saying they won't even bother geofencing restricted areas anymore, so this will probably happen again at some point, because unlike my tears, drones don't ricochet, they tear in the wings, Kim.
This actually damaged one of the wing stringers. They posted photos of the repair job. You should look it up. It's really interesting.
Yeah. All right. And finally, Airbus announced they won't rent out the Beluga anymore. My theory here is that really heavy thing that needs to go way the fuck over there really soon market isn't very big. This thing was designed to compete with the AA-2124 and the Dreamlifter, which both sold to Atlas. I thought renting this out was genius, but it's got kind of terrible range. It will mass out way before it bulks out. So really, the market was weirdly shaped shit needs to go place, and that just wasn't enough to keep these as a standalone business. Also, I love that this shares a type rating with the 300, the XL with the 330, but Boeing has to handcuff like half the world's airline passengers to a drafting table from the 1960s to keep one type.
My takeaway is that we missed our chance to hire the happiest plane on Earth.
Next slide.
Ha ha! Psych! We're not doing a 111 corner this time, because the entire episode is 111 corner. You're all going to have to wait to learn about the fly-by-wire 111.
Next slide.
All right, time to plug some capitalism. Our Discord, as we say, is CPIT. I'm going to take a second to say something. I might have emotional saying it. I know I got writing it. When we came up with CPIT, we wrote a podcast, and then we opened a Discord around it to discuss it. Over time, that's changed a little bit, and the Discord server became... well, we can describe it as being like a dive bar just outside the NASA Ames facility, and it's become a very wonderful place full of some of the best people I've ever met. The Discord server became the point of secret, and these episodes became content made for our fans as a reward for being the incredible and sweet group they are. It's one of the reasons these episodes went from week, sort of a few weeks, to monthly, to sort of quarterly. We are hoping to get them back to being more regular, I promise, but we've had a pretty eventful second half of 2024, which included moves across town, moves across the country, job changes, international vacations. One of us got hit and run by a no-shoot minivan.
Yeah, it was me. I got hit by a minivan.
All right, we do bonus episodes. We include things like we do Oops All Newses, we do movie analysis, where we take turns picking movies and analyze them. Kira likes weird Russian movies. Jay likes the movies that forge into the engineer they are. And I like to make movies. One of these days, I'm going to make these two watch a movie with Thomas Cruise Control.
And on that note, let's talk about Braniff Flight 250, also known as that time a BAC-111 fought the state of Nebraska and lost. Next slide.
So what is this in today's episode about? We're going to talk about Braniff. What is a Braniff? Next slide.
I'm pretty sure that's Branson, Missouri. Nope, that's a bran muffin. That's Oscar-nominated director Kenneth Branagh. That, I believe, is Baffin Island. Nope, that's Banff.
Isn't that where Beck is from?
No, she's from Nova Scotia. That's like a 7-hour flight away.
40, if you're on Air Canada.
There we go, that's Braniff. Wow, that's a lot of orange.
It looks kind of like a creamsicle.
It does. Yeah, the original 747 is always so snappy and weird. Braniff, or Braniff International Airlines, was what you would describe today as a shitty little regional. Back then, however, they were known as a trunk carrier. This meant they were founded before the airline industry got heavily regulated, and whatever routes they flew were basically locked in by government regulation. Their business was protected. In other words, the federal government had declared it illegal or impossible to compete with them. Those of you who study civics know this as regulatory capture. Those of you who have any kind of job expecting this on behalf of the government may know this as the thing that makes your life hard.
Airline deregulation killed off a bunch of these, but what you need to know is that Braniff is an airline that performed regional flights between states, primarily in Tornado Alley.
I would simply not go to a place called Tornado Alley, but I'm built different. And by different, I mean delicately.
We do have one fun Braniff fact. Next slide. They operated Concorde for a bit as a treat. They ended up not buying any in the end. They did have an option for them, but they just didn't buy them.
Seeing it in this color is so wrong. I hate it.
Hey, at least it's not the Pepsi Concorde.
All right, next slide. All right, so what is on 111?
The story is Peak 111 doing 6 legs in a day.
Only 6? It was designed to do 45-minute legs all day, every day. I am not making this up. That is what it was designed for.
Okay, I'll do what is AN-111. It's what happens when you design a plane without compromise.
A quick bit of background for those of you that aren't up on your seatbelt lore, and fair enough if you're not. The 111 is a small regional jet. It's in fact the first short-haul regional airliner to ever have been built. And I mean small. It's around 100 feet long. Smaller than any 220 or current 737. It's actually about the same size as a 737-100.
It was built using similar manufacturing techniques to its younger, hotter sister, Concorde. And yes, this is grossly excessive, but they figured that if you're, and they marketed it this way, bus stop jet is going to do 15 pressure cycles in a day, it needs to be extremely strong for the airframe not to do an Aloha 243, or more to the point, a de Havilland Comet.
The fact that this thing was designed to fly a bunch of routes a day to serve a market that never ended up existing meant that it was just the original airliner that was fantastically overbuilt and expensive.
Of course, the nature of BAC and its successor organization BAE meant that a decent chunk of that fantastic expense came directly from the British government, which means it came from my parents' taxes, I suppose.
This barn was brand new. Many airlines flew these things for 30 years on short trips, doing as many as 10 or 15 cycles a day. And there was never a need for an aging fleet program like Aloha 243. We are obsessed with this plane. It is our official Miu icon plane. We have done multiple Pepe Silva stream boards to show how instrumental this thing has been and how it's connected to everything from Taylor Swift's praying to the ULA Vulcan Centaur. Next slide. And last but definitely not least, let's turn it back to answer the question, what is a thunderstorm?
This is not a thunderstorm, but it is the Storm Spirits by Evelyn De Morgan. In this painting, you can clearly see wind shear, lightning, ridge turbulence, and other weather phenomena, and it is therefore very relevant and not just me trying to be highbrow while we all make poop jokes the rest of the time.
I really like that painting. It's kind of neat. I might have to...
I have a copy of it on my kitchen wall, actually.
It must be lovely to look at. I'll tell you about a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm is a bad bunch of weather. At its core, it's a lifting mechanism, which is commonly the sun heating the earth, causing warm air to rise. Moisture and instability. You add in a sprinkle of wind shear and you've got yourself a storm. It's bad for planes because it's windy, and it also has lightning. The explanations will get a lot more complicated from here on out, so pay attention.
Next slide. Okay, so the date is August 6th, 1966.
Where are we? Middle of nowhere, Nebraska. You don't need to know much more than that because the Midwest is the real place and everywhere there is the same as every other place there. But the flight starts in New Orleans, where our last flight ended, or really will end, I guess, decades from now. It's a flight going from NOLA to Minneapolis with stops along the way in Shreveport, Fort Smith, Tulsa, Kansas City, and Omaha. This particular section is the second to last one between Kansas City and Omaha. Next slide.
Wow, that colorway is worse than the orange.
Yeah, no kidding.
Our aircraft, which you can see here, is N-1553, built in 1965. It's actually brand new. They crashed a shiny, new, fresh 111. I bet it even still had new plane smell. Specifically, it's a BAC 111-203AE, which is to say that it's the shorty model with the Spey Mark 506 engines. It has the ventral air stairs. It does not have the hush kit because it was the 60s. Ah, the 60s, when jet engines were loud and BAC was going to make Concorde happen any day now. This is the 70th 111 to be built, including the four prototype and development planes, one of which was messily crashed.
Anyway, on the flight deck today, we have Captain Donald Pauly and First Officer James Hilliker. Out of Pauly's 20,767 flying hours, only 549 are on the BAC-111, while Hilliker has less total flying hours with 9,269, but 685 of those were on the BAC-111. And that's actually not going to be relevant at all, but it's just, it's information everybody wants for some reason. So anyway, it's just before 11 p.m., and these guys are in Kansas City, about to fly the next leg of Flight 250 to Omaha. Now, according to people who talked with him, Captain Pauly had been worried about the weather on this part of the flight since all the way back in New Orleans. So, Beck, do you want to tell us why that was the case? Next slide.
All right. So let's first discuss the forecast from various weather offices that day to paint a picture of the severity of the situation. On the day of the accident, the National Meteorological Center produced a weather chart showing that a low pressure system was centered over western Wisconsin, and another low pressure system was centered over northeastern Kansas. The Weather Bureau Forecast Center at Kansas City filed for the time and place of the accident, called for a cold front extended from northwestern Iowa southwestward to northeast Colorado, moving toward central Kansas by 7 o'clock. And if that wasn't confusing for anybody else, it was confusing for me. You might need to get your compass out. Isolated severe thunderstorms with hail and gusts of 65 to 70 knots were forecast for the extreme southwestern Kansas and extreme northeastern Nebraska until 2200 and 2300 hours. Because of this, two SIGMETs were issued.
A SIGMET stands for Significant Meteorological Information, and they're issued by one of the three aviation weather centers in the U.S. to warn pilots of any weather condition that could be hazardous to flight.
And so, the first SIGMET called for a line of thunderstorms from Mason City, Iowa to Norfolk? It was in Nebraska. These thunderstorms were expected to become severe. The second called for occasional short lines of thunderstorm from Goodland, Kansas, northeastward, through Omaha, Nebraska, to Waterloo, Iowa. Also, Aviation Severe Weather Bulletin number 446 contained a severe thunderstorm forecast, which was valid from 2002 hours until midnight, August 6th. The area covered in the bulletin stretched along a line 20 miles southwest of Lincoln, Nebraska, to 40 miles south of Waterloo, Iowa, and included the area 60 nautical miles either side of that line. Surface wind gusts were projected to be up to 55 knots, and an active squall line was forecast from extreme southeastern Minnesota to northeastern Nebraska and was expected to move southeastward at 30 knots.
Next slide. Here we go. Here's a depiction of what Beck just described. So Beck, can you explain what a squall line is? Because that's going to be really important.
Yeah. So squall lines, or quasi-linear convective systems, are groupings of thunderstorms that are, you guessed it, formed in a line. These lines tend to run diagonal with the top edge leaning northeast and the bottom edge leaning southwest, shaped like a recurve bow. Associated with those lines of thunderstorms are intense winds. This is because of the warm air being forced up into the sky, supercooling and rapidly descending. When this happens, you get those rolling and boiling winds that continue eastward until they eventually run out of energy. Sometimes they even spawn short-lived tornadoes. It's angry, tubular-esque wind that likes to eat planes.
Right. So that's not something you really want to fly into. Which is why the manual for Braniff dispatchers stated that no flight shall be dispatched that knowingly requires penetration of thunderstorm cells. And it also stated that if a squall line existed along the flight path that could not be practically circumnavigated, then flights should be held on the ground. And as it turns out, the squall line over Iowa and Nebraska that night was pretty continuous. The crew of a Convair 580 headed south from Omaha encountered severe turbulence while trying to penetrate the squall line shortly before Braniff Flight 250 took off, and its flight recorder recorded that the plane was subjected to 2.85 positive vertical Gs, which is a lot. At around the same time, Braniff Flight 255 delayed its takeoff from Omaha because there wasn't a good route through the squall line. And another Braniff flight, Flight 234, from St. Louis to Des Moines, saw the squall line on radar, couldn't find a suitable gap anywhere within 75 miles in either direction, and decided to divert to Kansas City.
So by this point, you're probably thinking, well, maybe Flight 250 should wait for all of this to blow over. You know, have a drink in the airport bar, just wait. Surely you wouldn't dispatch a plane into those conditions? Well, that's exactly what Braniff did, so let's just take a moment to understand why.
And why they didn't just go home to wait out the shitstorm back in Texas.
Is that a Taylor Swift line?
Yes.
Knew it.
So the first issue was that Braniff's own forecast issued at 2000 hours only indicated a cold front, scattered moderate rain showers, and isolated thunderstorms. Not a squall line. The Braniff dispatcher at Kansas City checked the forecast and didn't think there was really anything hazardous about this weather. So he didn't ring up the National Weather Service to receive this severe weather bulletin or the SIGMET.
That's right. Back in those days, dispatchers had to actually call the NWS to get this stuff. It wasn't a great system. There was a system that allowed this info to get automatically faxed to dispatch offices, but it was a subscription service and it was voluntary. The report doesn't talk about it, but I'm guessing Braniff either wasn't subscribed or the dispatcher, for some unfathomable reason, couldn't be bothered.
Back in those days, it would have been analog fax, and they were quite subject to interference and, you know, the lines just not being working, and they were quite unreliable. Also, as if that wasn't bad enough, the dispatcher knew that Braniff Flight 255 had delayed its departure from Omaha, and it knew that Braniff Flight 234 had diverted to Kansas City because of weather, because neither of them could see a way through this squall line.
But the dispatcher didn't know about the squall line, so he thought these reports were irrelevant because they were too far from Flight 250's intended flight path, even though they were all the path of the same squall line.
So meanwhile, our Captain Polly arrives at Kansas City Airport and he meets the pilot of a flight that had just arrived from Chicago. That captain said he told Captain Polly that there was a solid line of very intense thunderstorms with continuous lightning and no apparent breaks, as long and mean a one as I'd seen in a long time, and I didn't feel the radar reports gave a true picture of the intensity, end quote. In response, Captain Polly said he hoped to get to the west of the line.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. I just heard that line in the voice of the narrator from The Big Lebowski.
Okay.
It's a very 1960s line, and incidentally, this crash is actually mentioned in Mad Men. So it's just, perhaps that's why the dialogue sounds. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it is.
Is it? Okay, that's really interesting.
Captain Polly said he hoped to get to the west of the line.
We can't be sure why he thought this was a good idea.
Maybe he was huffing glue or influenced by all of his prior experience on Douglas aircraft.
This is a bad choice when trying to get around a squall line in the Midwestern states. When flying northbound, though, never go west. West is bad.
Hey, we like the west here. It's got Washington State, California, Oregon. It's where I keep all my stuff. And it also has most of the Wicked Witches, at least.
Can I sing Defying Gravity?
No, you cannot.
Okay, west in this case is bad because the squall lines in that region tend to run from northeast to southwest while moving in a generally easterly direction. So if you're flying northbound, turning west, usually, but not always, either takes you right into the squall line or puts you in a position to get overrun by it. Note that this isn't like official aeronautical guidance or anything. It's just a general geometry-based truth that's obvious by looking at it.
So what you're saying is that you cannot always go around because that doesn't apply to storms.
Yeah, pretty much. Squall lines are predictable and hard to miss. There's usually plenty of warning, so the solution is to just wait until it passes before taking off. Don't try to go around. I mean, you can try to go around. Sometimes it can be done, but often it can't. So anyway, this captain from Chicago just basically described a squall line to Captain Polly. So Polly calls up the Braniff dispatcher and receives the dispatch paperwork. This has Braniff's own forecast in it, but it doesn't have the SIGMET or the severe weather bulletin because the dispatcher couldn't be arsed to get them. So he reads over this paperwork and goes, eh, it should be fine after all. And that's how we get to Flight 250 taking off into a big fuck-off squall line where it had no business being. Next slide, please. So Flight 250 departs Kansas City with 38 passengers and 4 crew on board, flying northwest. Initially, they're limited to 5,000 feet for traffic separation, so they have to wait to climb to their cruising altitude of 20,000 feet. While flying level at 5,000 feet, the crew requested to deviate left of course, that is, to the west, which is what Captain Polly had said he was going to do. They also requested to remain at 5,000 feet all the way to Omaha, which wasn't explained in the report. I'm not entirely sure why they did that. I mean, it was a short flight, but it wasn't so short that they couldn't have climbed a lot higher. And this is something I've observed a few times in researching flights from this era. And I think there might have been a sort of misguided belief that it was easier to better somehow to penetrate thunderstorms at a low altitude in order to stay in clear air and avoid precipitation areas visually. But it's certainly not a good idea, and it's pretty weird to me that anyone would do this.
It might have been because of icing concerns. A lot of planes in this era didn't have robust anti-ice systems. Anyway, Kansas City cleared Flight 250 to maintain 5,000 feet and deviate left, and then they contacted Chicago Center. The crew had a back-and-forth conversation with the Chicago controller about what was on their weather radar, and the controller advised them that the squall line was basically solid, with no obvious gaps anywhere between Des Moines, Iowa, and Pawnee City, Nebraska, which is well over 150 miles.
At this point, First Officer Hilliker suggests that they deviate even farther west to try to find a gap at Pawnee City, but Captain Pauly ignores him.
1960 Sarah Mill, if the captain wants your opinion, he will give it to you.
Instead, Chicago advises them that Braniff Flight 255 has finally taken off from Omaha after an hour delay on the ground and is crossing the squall line presently, so Flight 250 calls them up to chat, and the crew of Flight 255 says they were climbing to 17,000 feet and reported light to moderate turbulence starting 15 miles southwest of Omaha, and they predicted they would remain in it for another 10 minutes based on radar. So generally not a bad report. But in later testimony to the NTSB, the pilots of that flight said they had to deviate 40 miles east of course to find a gap. And even then, after penetrating the squall line, they encountered strong turbulence and clear air ahead of the storms that threw the plane around at the force of plus 2.5 Gs. But that hadn't happened yet, so the crew of Flight 250 didn't know about it. So at local time, 2308, Flight 250 signs off with Flight 255, and that's the last anyone ever hears from Flight 250. Captain Pauly thought he saw a gap near Falls City, Nebraska. That's an extreme southeast Nebraska, as you can see on this map. He saw this gap using their weather radar and decided to go for it. And witnesses on the ground near Falls City could see the plane clearly, flying at a pretty low altitude, lit by the full moon, flying directly toward a massive thunderstorm that's looming over the endless cornfields like a Lovecraftian horror.
It sounds pretty terrifying. As they watch, the plane flies over something known as a roll cloud, which means it's time for our accident sequence.
Next slide.
I think it would be more of a Stephen King horror than a Lovecraftian one if it's cornfields, right?
Oh, God.
Oh, and planes.
Yes, but Stephen King, but this accident wasn't in Maine, so it can't be Stephen King.
That's also true.
That is true.
So our exit sequence has begun, which takes us to whoop whoop pull up. Next slide.
So Beck, it's weather autism time. What were these guys flying into?
Woohoo, glad you asked. Witnesses on the ground on the day of the accident reported seeing roll clouds or shelf clouds and surface winds estimated to have been as high as 70 miles per hour. That's pretty windy. What you see on your screen right now is a roll cloud. It's the beautiful, round, fluffy, dangerous-looking cloud. To understand a roll cloud, basically you have to understand that a thunderstorm is an engine that makes warm air go up, cold air go down. A cold front pushes cold air into an area of warm air. The warm air tries to rise above the cold air because it's less dense, and as it rises, losing energy until it gets cold and falls back down. This cycle is called convection. Anyway, the point is you have cold air rushing down to the ground and spreading outward. Well, warm air rushes in over the top of this cold outflow. Roll clouds happen due to shear between the downrush of the cold air flowing out of the thunderstorm while the warm air ahead of the storm is trying to rise up into the clouds. Shear is a change in wind speed or direction over some horizontal or vertical distance. When air masses move past each other in different directions, the air between them starts to spin, just like rolling a pencil back and forth between your hands. So a roll circulation is specifically just a long tube-shaped mass of air rotating like a pencil between the thunderstorm's inflow and outflow. And if there's condensation in it, then what you see is a roll cloud. Kind of looks like a baguette. Now, part of the process involved in trying to figure out what exactly happened to the accident aircraft was an independent study conducted by a mesometeorologist. Which is to say that this weather person knows a lot about meteorological disturbances that take place on a mesoscale. That is, the study of weather systems at horizontal scales approximately 5 kilometers to several hundred kilometers. Some examples of weather measured by mesometeorologists would be tropical cyclones, thunderstorms, downslope windstorms, sea breezes, and of course, squall lines. The meteorologist testified that the amount of excess atmospheric pressure and the outflow wind speed of a weather system is proportional to the amount of surface rainfall if the height of the convective cloud base remains unchanged.
And to be clear, that's important because it determines how strong the inflow and outflow will be, and thus how strong the shear between them will be, which helps us understand how fucked Flight 250 was.
Yes, and how that meteorologist calculated that outflow could have been as strong as 60 to 70 miles per hour. However, at the same time, through measuring the spatial variation of the precipitation from one location to another, he was able to conclude that the rainfall in the area located 30 miles northeast of the accident site was four times that of the one to the west of the site. This means that the rain-induced cold air mass to the east was about four times larger than that of the one to the west. The outflow wind speed was therefore greater to the east than it was to the west, creating an area of shear between where the air masses moving at different speeds collided and slid past each other. This is the exact area that Flight 250 flew into. This means that not only did you have this strong 60 plus miles per hour outflow creating strong horizontal shear between different vertically stacked layers, you also had stronger outflow moving horizontally past the weaker outflow next to it, creating vertical circulation between these layers too. Basically, not good for planes. Very bouncy air, very turbulent air. Now, the insidious thing is that the maelstrom where these circulations meet isn't inside the precipitation column. It's actually out ahead of them along something called a gust front. The gust front, or boundary layer, is the boundary out ahead of the thunderstorm between the new warm air that gets yeeted up into the troposphere and the air that's already been yeeted has fallen back to Earth. It is about to get yeeted again. If you're on the ground and this gust front passes over you, you'll notice wind suddenly shift from warm blowing towards the storm to cold and blowing away from the storm. There's a lot of storm chasers. When you see them standing at the side of the fence watching a great big mesocyclone, they'll comment on how cold the air is getting around them, and that's how they know that things are really ticking up, because they're feeling that cold air come back out from the rear flank downdraft. But this isn't where all the rain and hail and stuff is falling down in the storm central downdraft. It can actually be miles ahead of it.
So if you're flying a BAC-111 in 1966, just for the sake of the argument, and you have weather radar that bounces radio waves off of precipitation, you can't see the gust front.
Exactly. When you have a zone of horizontal wind shear and strong up and down drafts like this, the velocity of these swirling eddies can be way faster than the overall straight line wind field. This type of wind has many times plucked planes out of the air and broken them apart. Fortunately, though, it's predictable, and that it can be found really in only two specific locations. The most common place this type of weather usually lives is alongside a mountain. Powerful straight-line winds encounter a mountaintop, rush over the summit, and form eddies in its wake, creating pockets of extreme turbulence.
This is called a mountain wave, by the way.
And they're very uncommonly found in Nebraska.
Very uncommon in Nebraska. That's true.
Yeah, it's not the right place to see a mountain wave. The other place you can find this kind of extreme turbulence is at the gust front of a severe thunderstorm. On the day of our accident, the plane ended up in an area that was most favorable for the development of roll circulations, eddies, and pockets of vorticity. Flight 250, in an effort to fly through what they thought was a weaker part of the squall line, deviated to the left and crossed the gust front at a location and altitude that was most favorable for these dangerous and unpredictable fast-changing winds.
And they did this at 5,000 feet, where the air is dense and has more mass, which made it worse.
Yeah, this is why, these days it's considered suicidal to fly into a severe thunderstorm at 5,000 feet, but we've learned a lot in 60 years. So anyway, yes, you were talking about dangerous and unpredictable fast-changing winds.
Yeah, and to use another technical term, it was heckin' windy. It wasn't even just windy, it was also spinny. And yes, planes do not like wind, but what they especially don't like is spinny wind.
I would simply not fly my plane to the roaring rampage of revenge, too.
Next slide.
Okay, so at this point, my notes just say, Jay talks about how hard you have to hit a 111 to break it. So here it goes, I guess. As we've discussed, the 111 is a massively over-engineered airframe. Many of the people who worked on its design had recently been involved in the Comet investigation, and I mean quite recently, like less than 10 years previously. Which is to say, they had worked in the British aircraft industry, because everyone was involved apparently in the Comet investigation. I mean, they even built a giant pressure testing tank in a quarry. They erred on the side of caution with the 111. the pressure hull is particularly over-engineered because the 111 is designed to fly a ridiculous number of pressure cycles over its lifespan, and often without departing from sea-level cabin altitude, because it was felt that this would be very tiring for the cabin crew and the pilots. But today, we're talking about tail break-off, Mr. Bond, because that's what it turns out happened to this particular plane. The 111 has a bigger than usual tail because it's designed to take off with a very wide range of CGs. What do you mean that's inefficient? Who cares? You're only flying this thing to get on a Concorde and oil is $8 a barrel, right? Anyway, like most aircraft, the vertical fin attaches with these four spar booms that fit into frame hoops at the back of the fuselage. You can see them on this slide here. It's designed to take the loads that the rudder and the elevator can apply to it. There's an artificial fuel system which increases the amount of force that a pilot would have to apply to the rudder to get a certain deflection based on how fast the plane is going. And this is intended to limit the amount of twisting force or torsion that the rudder can apply to the vertical fin, because with the shape of those spar booms, this is the direction it's least strong in. The elevator can apply more force, since that's the direction those structural spars actually run. And on the 111, it can apply quite a lot, because the tailplane is very large for the size of the aircraft. So you have to hit the 111 really hard to break it, none of which is at all relevant, because any plane would have broken if it was hit by the kind of gust that this one took. Just for some background, 111 pilots regarded the 111 as having exceptionally good handling in turbulence. We found a quote on a website that's delightfully called BAC111.com. No, really, it's a real website from the 90s. It looks like it's from the 90s.
I think it's still maintained too when I was looking. They seem to update it regularly still. It's quite delightful.
Yeah, it's up to date. We found a quote on BAC111.com where some dude named Michael Brett, who was apparently a 111 pilot for many years, said, and I quote, and I imagine he said it in a cut-glass English accent, so I'll do my best. The aircraft's handling qualities in adverse weather conditions remain an outstanding feature. This was demonstrated during investigation of at least two major accidents where wind shear / microburst type conditions were considered to be major factors. These same conditions were programmed into simulators of different transport types for comparison. The 111 recovered safely on many test approaches, whereas other types did not always make it. The BAC-111 airframe was probably the strongest ever built on an airliner. This was proved in 1967 when, due to an error, the wrong engine ATO was shut down and the 200 series 111 crash-landed at night on a partially wooded hillside north of Milan. Although the aircraft was refueled at Milan, there was no fire and the airframe remained intact. All passengers and crew walked away with no serious injuries. I was curious, so I looked up the ARB report on this incident, which is not an accident because no one was apparently injured. There's no note of any injuries. It notes, when the rescue party arrived several hours later, the passengers and crew were sitting in the woods, refreshing themselves from the retrieved catering and bar. This is peak British aviation.
Based.
Wow.
On top of that, in this incident, the accident report also states that BAC had conducted static strength testing and flight load testing that went well beyond the certification requirements. And BAC also complied with amendments that were issued after the type certificate application was submitted, which they were not required to do. So the FAA certificate review team reported that, quotes, the testing of structure, loads and fatigue has been very extensive and beyond the normal requirements. Anyway, my point is the 111 is probably the best possible jet airliner to fly into shitty weather in. And it still doesn't matter because if the storm spirits want you dead, they do in fact want you dead.
So what actually happened? So shortly after crossing over the roll cloud and into the gust front, the plane was hit by a sudden, extremely intense gust blowing up from below and right to left simultaneously at about 45 degrees, which appears to have broken off the horizontal stab and the vertical stabilizer. This gust was estimated at 140 feet per second, with an onset time of less than 1/8 of a second. The mass of the airplane didn't have time to accelerate with it, so all this force was borne by the tail structure itself. We don't have direct attestation of this gust other than the damage it did, but assuming the gust came at the most adverse angle, which would be up and from right to left, then the minimum gust strength required to produce this failure was estimated at 140 feet per second. That's how we got that number. We know it was an eighth of a second due to evidence from other sources. So 140 feet per second is only about 154 kilometers per hour, or the sustained wind speed inside a Category 2 hurricane. So not even close to the fastest wind speeds that are out there, or even the fastest wind speeds that airplanes fly in. But there are several factors that increase the severity of a gust. So first of all, you have to keep in mind that the airplane was not already being exposed to airflow coming from the direction of the gust, and thus the wind speed along the gust axis rose in 1/8 of a second to 154 kilometers per hour from zero, not from the speed they were flying, from zero. The speed with which the gust reaches its peak intensity is also crucial. So if a gust builds up to 154 kilometers per hour over a longer period of time, then the structure of the airplane will react to that to redistribute the loads, which is what Jay just said a minute ago. You know, basically, if you have a gust coming from the right with steadily increasing magnitude, the plane will naturally try to weathercock into the wind, which relieves the high stress. The plane is very happy pointing nose first into winds measuring a bajillion miles an hour. But if the gust reaches peak intensity too fast for the plane to weathercock into the wind, then the entire lateral component of the gust becomes a side load on the vertical stabilizer. And also at the same time, the entire vertical component is becoming a vertical load on the horizontal stabilizer. So the third factor affecting resistance to a gust load is the plane's forward airspeed. The faster the plane is moving, the lower the gust intensity required to fail the structure. In this case, the cockpit voice recorder captured a sound consistent with the plane suddenly encountering a very strong headwind that caused its speed relative to the air, you know, airspeed, to increase from the normal turbulence penetration speed of 270 knots up to as high as 320 knots, which caused a 10% reduction in the maximum gust intensity that the tail could withstand. So even though the tail was capable of withstanding a gust 50% more powerful than the maximum gust intensity expected in normal service, even this wasn't enough to withstand this gust because all of these factors combined like a sort of deadly weather Voltron.
Having gotten whacked by this extremely sudden off-axis gust of turbulence, the entire tail fin, including the rudder, broke off shortly thereafter, more or less simultaneously. Although the horizontal must have broken off first, since otherwise the wind wouldn't have been able to apply enough force to break it apart from the vertical fin without the mass of the plane to work against.
Yeah, so anyway, the lack of downforce on the tail, which is normally applied by the horizontal stabilizer, then caused the tailless plane to pitch so sharply nose down that the right wing was overloaded in upward bending and it broke off as well. At which point the plane went into a completely uncontrollable tumbling motion, transitioning into a flat spin, and after about 25 seconds it hit the ground, killing everyone on board. Next slide, please.
Okay, so let's talk about the aftermath.
This gust, which the NTSB reckoned would fail any commercial aircraft at the time, is not far outside the realms of what had been measured at the time. Moreover, it seems to have been much more common than they had estimated prior to this. Thunderstorms and squall lines are just really bad news for planes. Even a gratuitously overbuilt one like the 111 was pretty much completely incapable of dealing with the forces involved with such rapidly rising and rapidly changing winds.
So a huge problem pointed out by the NTSB was that this extreme weather was not only more common than measurements at the time seemed to indicate, it was also that the data on turbulence was gathered using past thunderstorm avoidance practices and with a much smaller fleet. But in the 1960s, the total number of miles flown by commercial aircraft was increasing exponentially, closing the statistical gap between the number of miles that must be flown to encounter catastrophic turbulence and the actual number of miles that were being flown in real life. And the number of passengers at risk had also massively increased. And yet, at the same time, the introduction of weather radar was causing pilots to fly ever closer to thunderstorms with ever greater confidence, even though that radar couldn't protect them from extreme turbulence. The weather radar could only see precipitation, not turbulence. The fact is that Flight 250 broke apart before it ever entered the thunderstorm cloud, while in what the pilots thought was clear air, 5 miles from the nearest precipitation visible on radar. And this is why today the official guidance is to stay the hell away from thunderstorms. Actually, to stay at least 20 nautical miles away if you can, and certainly do not under any circumstances get within 5 miles. The reason we don't see planes getting ripped apart by turbulence like this anymore is because, as Beck and I said earlier, there are only 2 places on Earth where you can find turbulence this strong. One, immediately downwind of a prominent mountain on a day with strong high-altitude straight-line winds, and in the gust front of a severe thunderstorm. So the solution is basically just don't fly there. And over subsequent years, while thunderstorm penetrations remained common, pilots got a lot better about exercising judgment about which thunderstorms were severe and which ones were just piddly little things. Of course, even the tiniest, wimpiest thunderstorms can produce microbursts, but that's a story for a completely different episode.
And a rant you've heard from me before.
Yes. Next slide, please.
Also, a couple of years after this crash, the same fucking airline did it again. Breda 352 on May 3rd, 1968. Broke up on a flight from Houston to Dallas. This one was the pilot making bad choices accident, not perhaps being thrown into a bad situation accident.
Yeah, particularly 2 bad choices. The first, to fly into a thunderstorm, and the second, to try and turn around. When you turn a plane, you introduce a bank angle so your wings are no longer level. Wings level is the most important thing that needs to happen when you're flying into any kind of adverse weather.
Yeah, when the bank angle is high, the angle of attack is higher as well, which reduces the stall margin. So in that case, the plane was hit by a gust from below that combined with the high bank angle to cause the plane to stall, flip over, and enter a dive. The pilots pulled up sharply during the recovery and the wings broke off due to the high G-forces. But anyway, kids, that's why if you find yourself flying inside a thunderstorm, just hold the yoke straight and pray. Do not turn around.
This crash, though, is not connected to the flutter incidents that took down Braniff 542 in 1959 and Northwest 710 in 1960. Those forced Lockheed to go back to the drawing board and massively reinforce Electra, making it perfect, ironically, for the WP-3D. I've had a lot of fun being here, and I just wanted to end on my favorite plane.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to deal with massive weather when you know what you're getting into. And hurricane hunting is something we'll have to touch on in a bonus episode at some point, because it's cool. Flying into thunderstorms on purpose? Hell yeah.
What a fuck to be learned. Next slide. Alright, for one, we got a hell of a lot better at detecting and predicting the storm behavior. We subsequently meant we stopped dispatching jets directly into the death weather.
And actually, that really is the main thing. We don't dispatch jets into the death weather. Not much to add there.
Alright. Next slide. Thanks everyone for joining us. Our next episode will be on Malaysia Air 370. Have a good night.
And good night.
This is where Taylor Swift releases a track named Lockheed Electra and just CPIT Discord just implodes.
That would be amazing.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, but we would implode harder if it was called BAC-111.
True.